Chapter 25. Havisham. That was Macbeth, as performed by the Yeast Shakespeare Company.
Ah, said Plum as I walked into his office. Miss next. Good news and bad news.
Better give me the bad news first. Plum took off his spectacles and polished them.
The ejector had. I've pulled the records and traced the manufacturing process all the way back to the original milliner. It seems that over 100 people have been involved in its manufacture, modification, and overhaul schedules. 15 years is a long service life for an ejector hat. Add the people with the know-how, and we've got a short list of about 600.
A broad net.
I'm afraid so.
I went to the window and looked out. Two peacocks were strutting across the lawn. What was the good news?
You know Miss Scarlett at Records?
Yes.
We're getting married on Tuesday.
Congratulations.
Thank you. Was there anything else?
I don't think so, I replied, walking to the door. Thanks for your help.
My pleasure, he replied kindly.
Tell Miss Havisham she should get a new ejector hat. This one is quite beyond repair.
It wasn't Havisham's. It was mine. He raised his eyebrows.
You're mistaken, he said after a pause. Look.
He pulled the battered Homburg from his desk and showed me Havisham's name etched on the sweatband with a number, manufacturing details, and size. But, I said slowly, I was wearing this hat in... The awful truth dawned. There must have been a mix-up with the hats. They hadn't been trying to kill me that day. They had been after Miss Havisham.
Problems? Said Plum.
Of the worst sort, I muttered. Can I use your footnotophone? I didn't wait for a reply. I picked up the brass horn and asked for Miss Havisham. She wasn't in the well, nor Great Expectations. I replaced the speaking horn and jumped to the lobby of the Great Library, where the general stores were situated. If anyone knew what Havisham was up to, it would be Wemmick. Mr. Wemmick wasn't busy. He was reading a newspaper with his feet on the counter.
Miss Next,
he said happily, getting up to shake my hand warmly.
What can I do for you?
Miss Havisham, I blurted out. Do you know where she is? Wemmick squirmed inwardly.
I'm not sure she'd like me to tell...
Wemmick, I cried. Someone tried to kill Miss Havisham and they may try again. He looked shocked and bit his lip.
I don't know where she is, he said slowly, but I know what she's doing.
My heart sank. It's another land speed attempt, isn't it? He nodded miserably. Where?
I don't know. She said the Higham wasn't powerful enough. She signed out the Bluebird, a twin-engine 2,500 horsepower brute of a car. It almost didn't fit in the storeroom.
Do you have any idea where she's going to drive it?
None at all.
Damn! I yelled, slamming my hand against the counter.
Think, Thursday, think!
I had an idea. I grasped the footnotophone and asked to be put through to Mr. Toad from Wind in the Willows. He wasn't in, but Ratty was, and after I had explained who I was and what I wanted, he gave me the information I needed. Havisham and Mr. Toad were racing on Pendeen Sands, in the Socialist Republic of Wales. I ran up the stairs and to the works of Dylan Thomas, picked up a slim volume of poetry and concentrated on my exit point in the outland. To my delight, it worked, and I was catapulted out of fiction and into an untidy heap in a small bookshop in Larne, Thomas's old village in the south of Wales. Now a shrine for Welsh and non-Welsh visitors alike, the bookshop was one of eight in the village selling nothing but Welsh literature and Thomas memorabilia. There was a scream from a startled book buyer as I appeared, and I stepped backwards in alarm only to fall over a pile of Welsh cookery books. I got up and ran from the shop as a car screeched to a halt in front of me. Pendeen Sands, with its 10 miles of flat beach, was down the coast from Larne, and I would need transport to get me there. I showed the driver my jurisdiction badge, which looked official even if it meant nothing, and said in my very best Welsh, Esquipus god vi ond blair my boss I Pendeen. She got the message and drove me along the road towards Pendeen. Before we arrived, I could see the Bluebird on the sands, together with Mr. Toad's car and a small group of people.
The tide was out and a broad expanse of inviting smooth sand greeted Miss Havisham. As I watched, my pulse racing, two plumes of black smoke erupted from the back of the record breaker as the engines fired up. Even through the window, I could hear the guttural cry of the engines. "Doch am Lein!" I urged the driver, and we swerved onto the car park just near the statue of John Parry Thomas. I ran down onto the beach, arms waving and yelling, but no one heard me above the roar of the engines, and even if they had, there was little reason for them to take any notice. "Hi!" I shouted. "Miss Havisham!" I ran as fast as I could, but only exhausted myself so that I ran slower with every passing step. "Stop!" I yelled, getting weaker and breathless. "For pity's sake!" But it was too late. With another deep growl, the car moved off and started to gather speed across the sand. I stopped and dropped to my knees, trying to gulp deep lungfuls of air, my heart racing. The car hurtled away from me, the engine roar fading as she tore along the hard sand. I watched it go at medium speed to the far end of the beach, then turn in a large arc for the first of her two runs. The engine growled again, rising to a high scream as the car gathered speed, the driving wheels throwing a shower of sand and pebbles far behind it. I willed her to be safe and for nothing to happen, and indeed, nothing did, until she was decelerating after the first run. I was breathing a sigh of relief when one of the front wheels broke loose and was dragged beneath the car, throwing it up into the air. The front edge of the bodywork dug into the sand and the car swerved violently sideways. I heard a cry of fear from the small crowd and a series of sickening thuds as the car rolled end over end down the beach, the engine screaming out of control as the wheels gripped nothing but air. It came to rest right way up, not 500 yards from me, and I ran towards it. I was 300 yards away when the petrol tank ignited into a mushroom of fire that lifted the 3-ton car from the sand. When I got there, I jumped onto the front of the car and pulled Miss Havisham from the burning wreck, dragged her clear and rolled her on the sand to extinguish the flames. "Water!" I cried. "Water for her burns!" The small crowd of onlookers were hopeless and could do nothing but stare at us in shock as I used my pocket knife to cut away the burnt remnants of her wedding veil. I winced as I worked. She was horribly burned. "Thursday," she murmured, although she couldn't see me. "Please, please take me home." I'd never jumped duel, taking someone with me, but I did it now. I jumped clean out of Pendeen and into Great Expectations, right into Miss Havisham's room at Satis House, next to the rotting wedding party that never was, the darkened room, the clock stopped at 8:40. It was the place where I had first seen her all those weeks ago, and it would be the place I saw her last. I laid her on the bed and tried to make her comfortable. "Cat!"
"Speaking."
"There's been a Code 12, fictional vehicle left on Pendeen Sands in the Outland. I need a fixed perimeter and a clean-up gang ASAP.
"I'm on it. How is she?"
"Not good, Chesh. I'll get back to you."
"Okay. A clean-up gang of Danvers are on their way now."
"Dear Thursday," said Miss Havisham, clasping my hand in hers. "Was it an accident?" "I don't know, Miss Havisham, but the ejector hat was not mine. It was intended for you," she sighed.
Then they got to me."
"Who?"
"I don't know. This is the book world, so it's got to be someone close and whom we don't suspect. Someone we thought was a friend."
"Bradshaw?" She shook her head and started to cough. For a moment, I didn't think she would stop. The jurisfiction medic jumped into the darkened room, followed by several nurses, who pushed me out of the way as they tried to cool and dress her wounds. But I couldn't get away. Havisham still had hold of my hand and pulled me closer.
"I will not come through this," she whispered.
"You'll be fine. In Great Expectations, you survive until the end. Can't let Dickens or the readers down, eh?"
"Then it looks like we will both be guilty of a fiction infraction, my dear."
She tried to smile, but couldn't make her swollen features do as she bid.
"I have enough strength to make a good exit. I will make my peace with Pip and Estella. A far better ending for me, I think."
"Miss Havisham!" I pleaded. Please don't talk this way.
You are close to me, my dear, she hissed. They will come for you next.
But why?
The formulaic Thursday. It is our enemy. Uphold fiction's independence. Beware of Big Martin and shun the frumious bandersnatch.
She's becoming delirious, said the medic,
as I felt her clasp loosen from mine, and with it I felt my eyes start to stream. More medics arrived, and I moved towards the back of the room, where Pip, Estella, and Mr. Pumblechook had all arrived to look on helplessly as the medics attempted to save her life.
You did what you could, said Pip slowly, and we are very grateful to you.
It wasn't enough, I said quietly. But she wants to improvise a new ending with you.
Then I will stay here, said Pip softly, until she regains consciousness.
We waited there, Pip and I, until Miss Havisham was well enough to make her final appearance in Great Expectations. She had bade farewell to the bellman and Bradshaw. The Council of Genres had even interrupted their busy schedule to rubber-stamp an internal plot adjustment to allow her to improvise her own fiery ending. An A2 generic was being trained to take her place even as we were saying our goodbyes. She took my arm, even though she couldn't see me, and pressed the ultra-word copy of The Little Prince into my hand.
The formulaic, she said again, is our one true enemy. Defend the book world against it. Promise me?
I promise.
You know, Thursday, you're going to be pretty good at this.
I thanked her.
One more thing.
I leaned closer.
Don't tell anyone I said this. But I don't think men are quite so bad as I make out.
I smiled. You might be right. She coughed again and signalled for me to leave. I had many questions I needed to ask, but she didn't have long and we both knew it. I nodded to Pip as we passed each other at the door, and I gently closed it behind me. I waited outside with a heavy heart and tensed as I heard a shriek and a flickering orange light shone beneath the door. I heard Pip curse, then more thumps and shouts as he smothered the fire with his cape. Jaw clenched, I turned away, my heart heavy with loss. She had been bossy and obnoxious, but she had protected me, rescued me, and taught me well. I have yet to meet a more extraordinary woman, either real or imagined, and she would always have a place in my heart.